From the Sky News Centre at 5, one of James Bulger's killers has admitted possessing child pornography. John Venables has been jailed for 2 years after pleading guilty via video link at the Old Bailey. James's mother, Denise Fergus, was in court and says the sentence is simply not enough. Harry Fletcher from the National Association of Probation Officers says it's impossible to tell what effect this spell in jail will have on Venables.
It's the most horrendous case that I think we've seen in years and years and years, because the victim was so little. He clearly tried to rehabilitate himself. He's failed. The authorities have now got to decide whether he deserves what will in fact be a third chance.
A heroin addict must spend at least 6 years in jail after running over a woman who tried to stop him stealing her sports car. Sean Higgins left Linda Hankey for dead outside her home in Wigan in January. The former Justice Secretary Jack Straw is considering attending a US Senate hearing into the release of the Lockerbie bomber. The Scottish Justice Secretary Kenny McCaskill's already declined a request to go. It's understood the committee had also considered inviting Tony Blair to give evidence. Mr Straw says he has no objection in principle and will decide later today.
I can't actually help them on the key issue, which I now found out is their central concern from their letter, which is why was Mr Megrahi released by the Scottish Executive on compassionate grounds? Now, I literally had nothing whatever to do with that.
There are worries that the latest strong growth figure for the UK is just a blip. GDP rose 1.1% between April and June, the highest rise since the first quarter of 2006. Sport, and all members of France's 23-man World Cup squad have been suspended for their next game by the country's Football Federation. It's after their disappointing campaign in South Africa, where players ended up refusing to train because teammate Nicolas Anelka was sent home. And the Queen is off on her holes. A luxury cruise ship's been privately chartered for a family holiday in the Western Isles of Scotland. Well, there'll be plenty of partying as the trip coincides with celebrations for Princess Anne's 60th and the 50th birthday of Prince Andrew. That's the latest. I'm Ursula Hansen.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
BCFM 93.2, broadcasting live from the Cascade Steps at the Bristol Harbour Festival, Saturday 31st July and Sunday 1st August.
Bristol Community FM 93.2, your voice, your choice.
Now, you've got an emergency.
Hi, this is Tony Gosling with the Friday Drive Time Show. And with us today is Martin Summers, Oxford economist, and Bristol City Councillor for the Liberal Democrat Party, Mike Popham. Now, my guest this week was to be leader of Bristol City Council, Council Barbara Jank, but she cancelled on Wednesday, explaining she had children to pick up from school. Instead, standing at the last minute in fine form, is Lib Dem Councillor for Clifton East, Mike Popham. After the 6 o'clock news, we devote a full hour to a leading US author and economist's five-point economic recovery plan, which the mainstream media cannot or will not see. The LibCon Coalition, too, have so far ignored lessons from the 1930s Great Depression, though it affects the homes and jobs of every single one of us. As Prime Minister David Cameron visits Barack Obama in the US and agrees a devil's pact to tighten the noose abroad around Iran and domestically around the public sector, we ask, without the public sector, why pay taxes? And forge a transatlantic alliance of common sense behind Obama and Cameron's backs, discussing, indeed, a five-point plan that politicians must implement if they really want to avoid a double-dip recession. We discuss economics as if people mattered with US historian and author of the unauthorised biography of George Bush Sr., that is, Webster Tarpley, in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. This weekend, highs of 20 Celsius, generally cloudy with some sunny spells, rain on Saturday afternoon, drier on Sunday. Highs of 21 degrees Celsius next week, fairly cloudy with some sunny spells, a few showers with possible heavy rain on Tuesday morning. Next weekend, that's the 31st of July and the 1st of August, nearly at August already, highs of 20 Celsius again, fairly cloudy with some sunny spells and some small showers just on Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guest now, and with me is Mike Popham. Hello, Mike, and welcome to Drive Time. Now, first of all, remind us, what's your background before you became a councillor on Bristol City Council?
Well, 20 years in the Royal Air Force. I resigned my commission in 1993, a long time ago.
So does that mean you were flying?
No, I was a rather boring communications engineer.
Okay. Now, you were actually one of the members of the cabinet, I think. You were, weren't you, last year, but you're not anymore. Why is that?
Well, this is my last year. I should be standing down next May, moving on. Good to have a relaxed time, I think.
And also, you were standing as a parliamentary candidate as well, weren't you, in the last election for Bristol East. So, are you standing down from doing that, or are you continuing that as well?
No, I continue as the what is called the parliamentary spokesman for Bristol East, in effect shadowing Kerry McCarthy, the Labour MP.
So what are your plans for the future? Do you want to step up from local politics into national politics, or are you stepping back and retiring, or doing something completely different?
Once you've gone through a general election campaign, you tend to feel for the area you've been trying to represent, and I certainly did bond with this quartile of the city. Having seen how the council looks at the city overall, what I will be doing is working closely with Barbara Jenk, the Liberal Democrat leader, to make sure that Bristol East is not unloved, unwanted, unnoticed, and then we get some change for the community here.
So you're not on the cabinet anymore that makes all these big decisions at the top of Bristol City Council, but you are on some committees. What committees are you on?
Just one, the planning committee.
Right, and were you involved in this decision to do with the Ashton Gate Stadium the other day?
No, that's done by the central planning control committee. I'm on the one for the north of the city.
Okay, and that year on the cabinet, what did it teach you about politics?
Politics apart, I had a very challenging and interesting job to do. So never mind the politics, get on and get some stuff in to benefit the public. And I covered the what they call the transformation brief, which is the back office functions and working out how to improve them for a better effect for the public, and thoroughly enjoyed that role, and we achieved quite a few interesting things.
So what was the idea? To really just cut down the council spending and cut down the amount needed to be brought in with council tax?
No, it's rarely you get the opportunity to take a real hard look at a service and work out how to better it. All this cost cutting is pretty damaging, really. What you've got to do is look at the service overall, how it hangs together, and if you think you can improve it by design, then you do, and that is transformation. What you do is you get a far better service out of it. Sometimes you put more money in, not less, but you get the service properly designed, properly resourced, everybody humming, and then it works better.
Can you just give us one concrete example of what you did? Because that's all sort of theoretical terms you're talking there.
Yeah, sure. The benefit service, that was, as we call it, re-engineered. Now, the performance of that entity prior to redesign, if I just recall my figures, it was something like 42,000 cases were being dealt with in 35 days. So 42,000 cases being dealt with in 35 days. It took 6 months to redesign it. After that, we were doing 5,000 more cases in 21 and a half days. So what that means to the public is they get the money faster.
Okay. Now, what are your thoughts on what's going on up in Westminster? Because you must be gazing up there from time to time, scratching your head and wondering. Are you happy about this LibCon coalition?
I'd rather have a Liberal Democrat government, but we're there to serve the public. The public, if you like, contrived to create quite an interesting mix of politicians in the House of Commons. From my perspective, I think the public deserves some no-nonsense politics, and with the Liberal Democrats operating within the Tory party, if you like, you've got an opposition within the government of the day. That seems pretty refreshing to me, given all the mistakes that we've had over the last sort of 13, 14 years.
But the seminal issue really going on right now is this whole thing of cuts. And we were told by Lib Dems in the run-up to the election that it was much better to make sure that we'd established a recovery before these cuts came in. And that's not happened, has it?
Let me just give you a personal example. In my first year on Bristol City Council, I shadowed a portfolio. So we were not in control. I shadowed that portfolio. To get information, to be able to analyse how things are going, is very difficult. So for an opposition party in London, just getting access to what the government is doing is actually a challenge. So it doesn't surprise me at all to find that now that with the change in government, they're now seeing things as they really are, and they're not quite the same as they were being told.
Right. So do you think this coalition is going to last for 5 years? I mean, I know you've got your fingers crossed, but do you think realistically that's going to happen?
I do. Seriously, I do. I think I'm astounded and proud at how Nick Clegg has dealt with the whole thing. Very, very challenging thing, really. But my goodness me, they got on with it, didn't they? Relationships were stable. you get tensions within a party, for goodness sake. So it's not unreasonable to get tensions between two parties working together. So tensions, that's good fresh politics to me. It's going very well, I'm pleased.
Well, we'll be hearing from Nick Clegg a little bit later in the programme in his first week as a sort of Deputy Prime Minister, given a little upgrade to be Prime Minister for the day for Prime Minister's questions. And we're also joined by, as usual, by old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, this week some pretty bad news from Greece about the murder of an investigative journalist who was exposing corruption at the top. So could you just enlighten us about that, and why is this significant?
Well, I haven't actually got the article in front of me, but I know that I can't remember the name of the person. But what's significant about this is that this assassination has been claimed by a hitherto unknown left-wing terrorist group. They're not November the 17th, which are the more famous left-wing terrorist group in Greece. It's a new group. And suspicions have to be that why are so-called left-wing terrorists murdering radical journalists exposing corruption at the top? And of course, this possibly has links with things that went on in Italy and Belgium in the 1970s and 1980s, where basically the security services are fomenting terrorism in order to steer a political result that they would like to see. Now, that may sound like conspiracy theory to people in Middle England and Bristol, but many people in Greece are very suspicious about this assassination, seeing the hand of the state rather than the hand of anybody else behind it. Others in Italy and Belgium and Spain would also see it in that way. People have got to understand that the security services in the West are capable of carrying out such acts and do them from time to time.
Well, I've got the article here in front of me. The guy's name, the journalist, is Socrates Giolas, and he was a radio chief. This new organisation that's popped up in Greece is called the Sect of Revolutionaries.
So it sounds like something from Monty Python, doesn't it? The Sect of Revolutionaries. Now, who might that be? They've also sent a letter bomb to the head of the Caribbean, well, the equivalent of the Carabinieri, which killed one of his assistants.
That's the police, Greek police.
Don't forget, you've got a lot of tension between the Greek police and protesters because of all this fighting that's gone on since the killing of that young boy about 18 months ago, which led to ongoing protests and confrontations. It's very reminiscent of what happened in Italy in the 1970s, when I visited as a younger chap than I am now. And of course, a lot of what transpired in Italy was that a lot of the violence was actually being fomented by the government. This was found out by parliamentary inquiry. It was the so-called Gladio network, GLADIO, which was linked to the security services, to the CIA, to MI6, and they were engaged in terrorist activities, including the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980, which killed 86 people. The assassination of Aldo Moro, who was the prime minister of Italy, was also attributed to this network, which was ostensibly done by the so-called Red Brigades at the time. Can you tell me the name of this so-called group again?
The Sect of Revolutionaries. A brand new group
called the Sect of Revolutionaries. It sounds a bit like Al-Qaeda to me. What does this mean? It's nothing serious. I mean, the November the 17th, which was the traditional terrorist group inside Italy, inside Greece, was named after the storming of Athens Polytechnic in 1972, in which hundreds of students were killed by the Western-backed military dictatorship. So November the 17th became a kind of rallying point for ultra-left opinion in Greece. But this group looks like a fake November the 17th to me, possibly with its roots inside the security services rather than anywhere else.
Well, this article was in Monday's Guardian, and Giolas, we're told, was also a frequent blogger, posting reports on popular online news blog Troktiko, Troktiko, and he sought to illuminate Greece's seamier underside. The shooting came days before he was due to release a big investigative series on corruption, his colleagues
said. So why would left-wing terrorists want to kill him, since he's a left-wing journalist exposing corruption at the top?
Good question. Well, on to our first story today, and this is to do with Bristol City Football Club. And the Bristol politicians, we're told on Bristol247.com, are lining up behind the furious club chairman. I'm not overplaying this. I know people expect me to put my hand in my pocket, says the chairman of Bristol City Football Club, and to put in the money Sainsbury's would have otherwise have paid us. That's not going to happen. This, of course, refers to the turning down of a planning application for a giant new Sainsbury's store in Bedminster. Martin, do you want to just start on this one?
Well, I think Mike possibly knows more about this topic than I do. I mean, I've only just read this story. It seems a very convoluted situation where a planning permission for a superstore is linked to a development with a football club, which is linked to the World Cup. And we're talking, you know, this is a very complicated web of decisions which seem to be unravelling. I haven't got strong opinions about this subject because I don't live in that side of town.
Well, what about the idea of knocking down the stadium as it is, putting up a superstore and then putting a new stadium out in Ashton Vale?
Well, I understand it, there was cross-party support for this proposal in earlier stages. I haven't got a strong opinion about it. I've heard the opposite opinion that perhaps the development shouldn't take place, but I don't really know.
Well, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter whether it's a football stadium or something else. The planning committee has to make a decision, and it's for them to make the decision. And it's not a party matter, really. No planning matter is a party matter. So they go in there, they bat for what they hear, what they see. Any significant change in a city is going to be convoluted from a number of dimensions. First of all, public opinion. Secondly, how on earth do you put the financial deal together? If you can get the money without a problem, then things are going to happen, aren't they? But we've got a club chairman here who's been instrumental in trying to forge a balanced solution for that part of the city. He's done his best, and it hasn't come off the way he wanted. It hasn't come off the way many people wanted. But I've had 3 years on planning in one straight run. You're dealing with hundreds of planning applications, not all as big as this. But what you do is you've got to have your feet on the ground, and what I was always guided by was who is likely to be most affected by this particular application. What's life going to be like for them? What do they actually want? And I would take that view into the committee and make a judgment based on that and what I hear in the committee. So it's complicated. It's gone that way. We've got to look to the planning committee to state their case, but that's it. That's it done. I'm sure we'll look at it again and try and forge an alternative plan.
Now, this is being put across as a great deal for Bristol. You know, increasing the resources in the city, having a much better stadium. But actually, there is another side to this, and this is that getting planning permission on this greenfield site massively increases the value of that land, and so the football club are actually going to be making actually quite a lot of money out of this deal. So, do you think that that's the profit motive is equally as important as actually just having the stadium itself?
I don't think so, actually.
I mean, nobody else would be able to build on this greenfield site, would they? I mean, if you or I wanted a planning application to put a house there or anything, there's no way we would get it.
I think there are easier ways of making money, frankly. No, this has come together through a common goal. And people looked at a challenge, looked at something they want to create, tried to string a deal together to make it happen. And at this stage, it's not going ahead as we'd thought it might.
So, is this plan dead in the water now, or is it likely to go on, do you think?
Well, I don't know, but I'm sure that it'll be looked at again. You know, there are more than one way to skin a cat. I'm not sure which way to skin to make this happen, but I can't believe that Steve would let this go lightly.
And it does seem as if a brand new enormous Sainsbury's there would really adversely affect a lot of the local traders around the Bedminster area, which is a little bit like Bedminster's a little bit like the Gloucester Road in a way, with lots and lots of small shops, all who would be affected by this deal. So I suspect that's why the committee has decided the way it did, because there's so much local opposition.
Exactly.
Well, maybe next time these big corporations and the people at the City Football Club will think a little bit more about their neighbours before they put in a big application like this. Right, we're moving on now to lessons learned after the Bristol 2010 election blunders. Bristol City Council has been heavily criticised in a report which analysed problems in the run-up to this year's general and local elections. Thousands of postal voters in Bristol West received papers meant for Bristol East, and ballot papers were found in the wrong box, delaying results. Some people didn't get any ballot papers at all either. Mike, do you have any insight into the way this has been being looked at by the City Council, and have you seen the report?
Not really. I fought the general election for Bristol East for the Lib Dems, a campaign that lasts for 4 months. When you get to that night, you're pretty exhausted, and you just hope that things will go well. We got through it.
It does say that actually they believe that the result of the election was not actually affected by all these problems. So do you think this is a bit of hot air now?
Well, nothing wrong with hot air, but the officers have a hell of a time at a general election, a really challenging time. They work thoroughly hard. The last thing they want is a city councillor having a go at them over the airways because things did not go well.
We've had years and years of elections, general elections and local elections here. You'd think they've got it right by now.
Things always change. That's the trouble. Legislation changes. There's always some tweak to an election. So there's a constant process of relearning, which is pretty boring stuff, frankly. Why on earth we can't stabilise and get a common system for general elections going? Don't change the blooming thing. I'm sure the officers will have an easier ride. I think we need to just stand by them and thank them for all they did.
Including all the cock-ups.
Absolutely, yeah. The outcome was not affected, and what they did was, what that means is that they overcame the problem they had. The tension, the stresses would have gone through the roof that night. Let's not keep knocking people.
Martin.
Well, obviously, I mean, the results were unaffected, so we can breathe a sigh of relief there. Obviously, though, we do need people to feel connected to the political process and feel confidence in it, and any kind of criticism of the actual conduct of the election leads to problems and alienation. What worries me going forward is the talk of redoing the constituencies, which the coalition are talking about, on the basis of the current electoral register. And we know that the current electoral register massively underrepresents people in private rented accommodation like myself. It massively underrepresents those under the age of 25. And, you know, we've got a real problem with a large number of people in this country, largely the poor and the marginalised, who are not on the electoral register. And even when they're on the electoral register, they're the least likely to vote. So attempts to redo the electoral map on the basis of the existing electoral register, I think, are extremely suspicious.
Mike?
Well, we seem to have moved on to another topic, really.
I've introduced the topic. Yes, I mean, I'm just saying that I'm worried about that. We do need to have an electoral system that everybody feels happy with. And for example, I'm in favour of PR and always have been, because it's a way of engaging people with the system. And if we look at what happened in Northern Ireland, everybody has to feel that they buy into the result, whether they won or whether they lost. And it's a very important thing, isn't it?
I can't help but be a little bit nervous about PR, because that's another big change for the election. I wonder if our officers will be able to cope with that.
We should have brought it in years ago. I mean, a lot of the problems we've got, which we'll probably come on to later, are because we have a very inflexible, old-fashioned political system, which is not fit for purpose, and that's why we make so many mistakes.
Now, Lib Dem leader and Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg got his first go at being Prime Minister this week, as David Cameron was off in Washington. So, how did he do? Let's have a listen. I don't think that's Nick Clegg, is it? But this is...
That's your signature tune.
Mr Speaker, yesterday my honourable friend, the Shadow Business Secretary, asked you about this, and you ruled that if a minister makes a factual error in a statement to the House, it is preferable that he or she should correct that error in the House. Will the right honourable gentleman now correct this error?
First, lest there's any confusion on the vital issue of Afghanistan, which I hope will continue to enjoy cross-party support, let me be absolutely clear that we will see our troops withdrawn from Afghanistan from a combat role by 2015. That is what we are determined to see happen. On Sheffield Forge Masters, Mr Speaker, the right honourable gentleman knows that the problem was simply one of affordability.
This Sheffield Forge Masters is a loan which the government have taken back now.
Writing out cheques to companies like Forge Masters, which he knew would bounce, all the while writing in his memoirs, I quote, we were deep in a pit of debt and still digging. That was what was wrong. What was wrong to pretend that there could be government assistance for a great company like Sheffield Forge Masters when, as the former Chief Secretary of the Treasury said, there was no money left?
Jack Straw! Well, Mr Speaker, I find it surprising that the Deputy Prime Minister, who has preached the importance of open and transparent and honest politics, cannot even bring himself to correct the record of something that was plainly wrong. Now, it is not the case that the explanation he is now offering is the explanation he offered before. Yes. The explanation he offered before was about the dilution of the company's shareholding or not. And that was the same explanation that was offered to this House by the Prime Minister. The question is, the Prime Minister told this House on the 7th of July, the question is whether it is an appropriate use of taxpayers' money to give it to a business which could raise that money by diluting its shareholding. Now that it is clear that the basis on which both he and the Prime Minister made the decision to refuse the loan was simply wrong, will he reconsider that decision?
That wasn't a question, it was a sort of dissertation. Mr. Speaker, he talks about openness and transparency. What would have been more open and transparent would have been if Lord Mandelson and his government had admitted there's no money. And by the way, don't take it from me. I think it was summed up rather well by one of the workers in Sheffield Forgemasters who...
I must appeal for calm. I can see members ranting at the tops of their voices at the Deputy Prime Minister. It is wrong and it must stop. Whatever the feeling, it must stop. The public detest it and so do I. The Deputy Prime Minister.
If he thinks that's a lot of noise, he should try it from there. It's even worse. Let me cite what a worker working in the shop floor of Sheffield Forgemaster said in the Sheffield Star just last week. On a visit to Sheffield Forgemasters by Lord Mandelson, he said, "I asked Lord Mandelson if the country was near to bankruptcy, where would the money come from? He turned away to speak to my gaffer. I asked him again, and he said very..."
Order, I'm sorry to have to interrupt the Deputy Prime Minister, but this is in itself very discursive, and it is not relevant to the precise responsibility... Order! ..of a member of the government. So we'll leave it... Order, I don't require any guidance. We'll leave it there. Jack Straw.
Now, that was a bit of a weird Prime Minister's questions, wasn't it? First of all, the Speaker, Burko, tells everyone to be quiet so we can have a listen to Nick Clegg. Then once Nick Clegg gets into his stride, the Speaker, Burko, then shuts him up and has the floor back to Jack Straw. Quite bizarre. And just at the point when he was about to tell us what Peter Mandelson had been talking about up at Sheffield Forgemasters, it just closed down the debate. So that was quite interesting. Anyway, what did you think, Martin, maybe you first, on the performance? And that was Jack Straw as well. I mean, he seemed a pretty lacklustre and dull, rather wordy performance to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to understand what point he was trying to make, isn't it? I mean, Nick Clegg also, to some extent, looks new in his new role. I think the whole issue underlying this of money for Sheffield Forgemasters, which are going to build nuclear power stations, which there's a whole question about whether we want nuclear power stations or whether we don't. There's also a question about whether there's no money or not. I think, of course, the whole election campaign was based on the idea that we must cut because our own front bench had bought into that sort of way of thinking. But now, of course, we hear from the ratings agencies that attempts to cut public expenditure will lead to Britain's credit rating being downgraded because you can't just cut your way out of a recession. I don't think David Cameron understood that. I don't think Nick Clegg understood that. I don't think Gordon Brown and Peter Mandelson certainly didn't understand that. So all these quotes from Mandelson don't cut any ice with me. Mandelson is another neoliberal fool from my point of view. We should not be cutting public expenditure now. That would be my view. And if we have to raise taxes on the wealthy, and I mean on their wealth, not their income, to do it, then so be it. But we're going to have to start talking like that.
So what are your thoughts, Mike, on your leader's performance and his first pretend try at being Prime Minister as a Deputy Prime Minister standing in for David Cameron?
Well, I'm delighted with how he performed. I probably would say that, but I'm actually delighted and proud of the way he put himself across and how he dealt with the questions. But let's look at it from a different perspective. We've had a switch in governments. The Labour Party were, you know, they're up and opposing, as they should do, so they've assumed their proper role. And I've got to say, although some people have described Jack Straw's performance as lacklustre, what he actually was doing was being incisive and forensic in his questions. Pretty complicated, but that's what he was trying to do. And that's good for a guy to do that. He's got to challenge the government. He did the best job he could. It's a bit of a complicated situation, but what I understand is that this company did actually have a strong order book. Now, if it's got a strong order book, then it doesn't need a loan from the government. And if the government can see a reason to switch that money to some better role, given that the company will not be damaged by the loan not being provided, then that's a good decision in my view.
Okay, now let's have a look at our second and final clip from Prime Minister's Questions this week. And this is where Nick Clegg says that he believes the Iraq war was illegal.
Yeah.
On the issue of progress, could the Deputy Prime Minister...
Sorry. Well, I think the Right Honourable Gentleman has had his allotted span. I apologise, it felt like it. Jack Straw...
With apologies to the Honourable Lady for devices, Mr Speaker. Mr Speaker, just over a month before the election, the Right Honourable Gentleman warned about the dangers of the kind of policies he's now following. He said, just imagine the reaction of my constituents in South West Sheffield. People like that are going to say, who are these people telling us they're suddenly going to take our jobs away? Who are these people? Well, Mr Speaker, now we know who these people are. Are they not the Liberal Democrats? People who are giving power to the Conservatives without any influence over the policies which they used to oppose.
Mr Speaker, he may bellow as much as he likes. I am happy to account for everything we're doing in this coalition government. A coalition government which has brought together two parties working in the national interest to sort out the mess that he left behind. But maybe he one day, perhaps we'll have to wait for his memoirs, could account for his role in the most disastrous decision of all, which is the illegal invasion of Iraq.
Claire Perry!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Order. The House really must start to behave itself. We've made slow progress. Order! That progress must get faster from now on with short questions and short answers. Claire Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Third time lucky. Could the Deputy Prime Minister tell us what the Coalition Government has done in 10 short weeks?
That was another extract there from Prime Minister's Questions this week. Straight to you, Mike Popham, Lib Dem councillor. Power without influence, that's what Jack Straw's accusing Nick Clegg of having.
Well, I certainly think he's got a downside more influence than he had before, and he's fulfilling a full role for the government, so he's got authority, actually.
Martin, and also Nick Clegg is asserting that actually what's going on here is a coalition in the national interest.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any problem with having a coalition, and I don't think a lot of mudslinging one way or the other solves the national dialogue that we need to have. We need to have a serious discussion about the direction we're going in. The reason I don't agree with what the coalition's policies are is because I don't agree with the direction of travel in terms of cutting public expenditure. I perfectly understand why the Liberals felt they had to go into an alliance with the Conservatives, because people on our side were being so obstructive and difficult about forming an alliance from our point of view. And of course, if we'd had a PR electoral system, that would have boosted your standing in the final result, and we would then probably have been negotiating a rather different coalition than the one we've ended up with. I haven't got a problem with coalition politics. For me, it's normal stuff. It's what's normal in other parts of Europe, in Ireland, in Poland, where I used to live. It's nothing to be worried about. What's worrying, and what we need to get into, is where are we going? Because I think that the economic policy being pursued, and I don't think the Liberals are going into this economic policy with their eyes closed, they do believe in cutting public expenditure, but I think that they are wrong in believing such a thing, and they ought to go back to their own traditions, the traditions of Keynes and Beveridge, and recognise that cutting public expenditure is simply wrong.
Yeah, just following on Martin's point about cuts, there's a lot of rhetoric and language coming out of government right now. How does that relate to reality? What they're actually doing is they are looking at the piece, they're looking at how money is spent, where it's spent, to what value that money is being consumed, and they're testing the system to find out how on earth they can reduce expenditure without damaging services to get us back onto a proper course. That'll take a while. They're not going to do that in two minutes. So we need to just take a breath, watch how things go for the next few months, and then we will see the practicalities of the direction of travel that Martin wants to see coming out, and then we can look at that and analyse that and see just you know what they're actually going to do for real.
Well, haven't there been some figures coming out this week that actually shows that economic growth is up on what was expected? So that is, it does seem like Alistair Darling and the previous government were actually setting the economy in the right direction, and maybe as there was a bit of a pickup in the economy, maybe cuts, it is okay to do the cuts now.
Yeah, but we tend to look inward, and this whole country has been looking inward in economic terms. When you're running out of money, you've got to trade. You can trade internally, but you're still, you know, you're just moving money around. We have to trade internationally. We've had a very bad image projected from these islands over the Iraq war, and what we've been doing on the international stage. We need to get back to ethical politics, proper trading, trading internationally, and driving this country forward with new money coming from overseas.
But unfortunately, we don't really seem to have much of a manufacturing base anymore. So what on earth are we going to trade with?
Well, I think there are pockets of high technology growth that will drive this country forward. So, you know, we shouldn't imagine manufacturing to be large monoliths as it used to be. There's a lot of innovation in this country. We ought to be proud of it and promote it.
Well, it's 25 to 6 now, and time to take a break from our news review to hear our guest Mike Popham's choice of music. Mike, what's the song and why did you choose it?
Okay, it's Nights in White Satin, but it's being sung by a group called Il Divo, and they're a four-man operatic group. And it's good to see that this song has remained the classic that it really is.
Notte di luce, una notte infinita, una lettera che non sarà mai spedita. Cos'è la realtà? Io non lo so più. Ad occhi aperti, il mio sogno sei tu. Io ti amo. Gente, mano per mano, nessuno capisce quello che provo. Respiro il silenzio dei tuoi pensieri. Un giorno sarai tutto quello che speri. Io ti amo.
Oh! That was Nights in White Satin by Il Divo. Very grand sounding bit of music there, chosen by today's guest, who's Liberal Democrat City Councillor for Clifton East, Mike Popham. Now, Marina Morris is joining me. Marina has a report this week on education.
Hello. The new government is imposing major cuts to the school capital programme. 735 schools in England have had their building project cancelled after Educational Secretary Michael Gove announced the building schools for the future programme would be scrapped. The Labour government children's plan was intended to make Britain the best place in the world to grow up. The new government now tell us that we can't afford it. The new direction of the coalition government. 50 million has been allocated for free schools, which will open in 2011. Parents, teachers, charities and businesses can apply to set up their own schools. Such schools would be state school funded by the taxpayers, not selective and free to attend, but they would not be controlled by local authorities or subject to local planning or need and provision. The concept of free school is based upon a similar model found in Sweden. The Academies Bill introduced in the 2010 Queen's speech will allow the creation of the schools and allow all existing state schools to become academy schools. It has just been announced that around 50 more existing state schools have applied to become academies. Bristol has already had new or substantially refurbished buildings for all 20 of its secondary schools. The councils surrounding Bristol have not been so lucky. According to the Bristol budget book, Bristol state-funded schools have a dedicated school grant for 2010-11 in excess of 204 million. In addition, nearly a quarter, 95 million of the council, almost of 400 million revenue budget is allocated to children, young people and skills. How much of this will escape further cuts remains unclear. The budget forecasts educational cuts of up to 25% over the next 4 years and a pay freeze for teachers from 2011. What is expected from preschools? To quote parents, we want what is the best for our kids. In principle, the power would reside with parents, but what does best means, it's not clear. 82% of parents want schools to keep them better informed, follow survey 2009. Only 16% of children proactively talk about their school days. The Medical College, together with the Faculty of Public Health, Diabetes UK and the National Health Forum wrote, ensuring that all primary school children living in poverty receive a healthy school meal would make a considerable contribution to reducing both educational and health inequalities. Eating food and drink high in fat, sugar or salt is linking to poor behavior, resulting in poor discipline and educational engagement for all children. By contrast, healthier school meals have been shown to improve classroom behavior, helping to improve academic performance and attainment. But this is just one of many possible ways to improve a school's life. Last year, the European League table of young people's well-being placed the UK 24th out of 29 countries. Only Romania, Bulgaria, Latvia, Lithuania and Malta scored worse than the UK, according to the research which was based on data from 2006. Graduates have recently been warned that there are on average 70 applicants for every job. Unemployment in the young is booming and the job market falls away and older employers can choose to work longer. What incentives are there for children to study and outcompete when they see so many of their peers unemployed? How can children survive and thrive in a future 21st century economy demanding high skills levels, these high levels of stress and mental pressure? The one of the ways of improving the learning process is to give children a vision of their future desired career, what they want to achieve. It will motivate them to learn hard and will help consciously to understand the price of achieving their goals. A vision how they would like to be in old age will motivate children to be healthy. It is our duty as teachers and parents to recognize what this time needs or lacks in modern education and to equip children with their inner strengths to cope with this repeated rejection, overcome the negative emotions, and try again, unloading by any mistakes, to compete harder and safeguard their health. This is a great area for teaching and change in new free schools.
Thank you very much, Marina. Now, Mike Popham, Lib Dem councillor, could you just explain what is the point of getting education right when children finish their education, there simply aren't the jobs for them, which was the main thrust of Marina's report there?
Well, I don't think you can speak against wanting the best education for children, no matter what the job prospects. The point is that they're educated well, they're made, their chances in life are made better as a result of education. It's a matter for the private sector and public sector employees to get the employment side right.
Martin?
Well, obviously, it's the problem we're going to face if we do have another generation, as in the 80s, which looks forward to a very bleak future, is that their commitment to education gets eroded. And then other cultures start to take over. We saw the lad that was killed on my street a couple of weeks ago.
That's on Stapleton Road.
That's on Stapleton Road. We don't know all the details, but I mean, what can happen if you have a perception, as in the 1980s developed, that there is no real future, is that that young people develop their own codes and mechanisms for finding approval and self-esteem, but that they're actually quite destructive of themselves.
Well, the thing is, of course,
and for the wider society.
Legitimate economy, it becomes difficult, and it becomes very difficult to get a job, and of course there's the underground, the drug economy.
Yeah, well, I saw similar stuff. I used to work in Eastern Europe as an aid worker and as an advisor, and of course the similar problems happened there, is that young people were drawn into criminal activity because there was nothing else for them to do, and I think that's a real danger. I mean, we saw this happen in the past, in the previous recessions that we've seen. It's not unlikely that it might happen in the future, and I don't have any easy answers for that, apart from not to have the recession depression, which is coming back to the economic argument. But young people need a sense of a future. I mean, if you've got an older brother and a father that have never worked, then your motivation to get involved and try and improve yourself is going to be quite limited. And this has been, you know, there's been an undercurrent of this for a very long time. We haven't had full employment in this country since the early 1970s. So we've always had a kind of developing underclass of unemployed people, which has gradually created all of these social problems for itself and for others.
Yeah, of course, one of the spin-offs for all this, Mike, is we've had over the last 20 years or so an increased emphasis on vocational education rather than people just being educated in pure subjects for their own sake, and yet the jobs are falling away.
Yeah, well, we can only go forward. Let's not talk ourselves down too much. During the general election campaign, I had the chance to go to three schools and receive questions from youngsters there. And I can tell you the quality of the questions were far, far higher than I could have managed when I was that age with the schooling that I had. So I think education standards, from what I see, and I see very little, frankly, have gone up. It's a matter of, as I said before, of employers getting it right for kids to bring them on stream, and for the teachers to be supported like we've never supported them before, really.
Now, I'd just like to mention a couple of stories about education that have been in the news this week to add to Marina's report. First of all, the Conservatives are using terror laws to rush Academy's bill through the House, according to one of the newspapers this Tuesday. Apparently, the parliamentary timetable, normally reserved for emergency legislation in areas such as terrorism, the fact that this is what is being used to bring in this Academy's bill, which has been described as being railroaded onto the statute book to avoid proper scrutiny. Now, Martin, this is a little bit concerning, isn't it, that this sort of special fast-tracking for bills, terror bills, is being used to get the Academy's bill on the statute book?
Well, it does seem a bit strange, because if something like an Academy's bill, I mean, I don't agree with the bill, we can go into why not if you like, but it does seem to me the sort of thing that's a long-term kind of decision and not something you should be rushing through with emergency legislation. And a lot of teachers in existing schools will be dismayed, A, that this has come forward in the way that it has, because, of course, most teachers are absolutely opposed to these new academies, and also shocked at the speed, the blitzkrieg effect. suspect that we've got a similar thing with the health service, the so-called reforms of the health service. People working in the health service are also shocked because much of this was not discussed in the election campaign. And what the suspicion is that this whole agenda of cuts and privatisation in education and health is not actually being decided by our government. It's being decided by powers beyond them. We're talking now about Wall Street, which has bought the American government, which are truly the people in charge.
Yeah, there was also a discussion about this on BBC's Question Time last night. I'm not sure if you two watched it, but they had a head of a school there who was saying that his school over the last 3 years has been preparing to move and was relying on this funding as part of that move. And now they actually don't know what they're going to be doing at the end of the summer holiday. Mike, this is just not acceptable, is it?
No, it's not. The least we can do with our teachers is to give them clarity of intent. And I mean, it's not right to mix the word terrorism with this topic. But clearly, it's very, very disappointing to see a new government using a fast track procedure in the House inappropriately. And I just worry about the school system to be able to absorb changes that are forced through. Politicians need to sit up, not be afraid of opposition. And they need to use the Labour Party on the other side, really as a sounding board for things, and be a bit, you know, display a bit of confidence.
Now, the Gove
has been pretty awful on this.
Well, Education Secretary Michael Gove was a member at Oxford of the Bullingdon Club, this elitist club in Oxford, with David Cameron and George Osborne, and it seems that it's almost like a sort of little Oxford clique running things.
This is really back
to the worst days of politics, and certainly not the new politics we were being told about, Mike. So, you know, you are actually in bed with the Bullingdon Club clique.
I wouldn't quite put it like that, but but no, I Nick Clegg ought to sort him out. You know, call him in for a meeting, have a fierce chat, tell him to strengthen himself and not be afraid to allow due process to occur on major issues.
Now on to another story from Bridgewater. A police officer blasted an innocent man in the groin with a 50,000 volt taser by accident. This was in the Daily Mail, has made the national papers, this rather nasty incident down in Bridgewater. A man was shot in the groin with a taser gun by police who wrongly believed he had been driving without insurance. Peter Cox was given a massive electric shock after he climbed out of his BMW to talk to officers who'd been following him. It later emerged that Mr. Cox's car was insured. Officers had been tailing the motorist as he drove through Bridgewater in Somerset when he stopped at the home of his partner Donna Allen, where he was going to do some gardening. He asked the police what they wanted. He said, "I asked them to park on the other side of the road because we were working in the front garden." The officer didn't say anything, but he got out of the car, pulled out a taser and pointed it at me. I didn't know this at the time, so I just went on with what I was doing and got a bag of stone for the garden out of the boot. Then he shot me. Mr. Cox denied acting aggressively. He said that the taser missed his genitals by 3 inches. He continued, "I was really shocked." Shocked is not exactly the right word to use, is it? "And I didn't know what was going on. I got one in my groin and one in my ankle. It really hurt. It just stunned me completely, and it felt like someone was stabbing me with a fork all over my body." He added, "Police should not be armed with tasers if they cannot use them properly. It was incredibly painful and totally paralysed me." Paramedics treated Mr. Cox, who suffers from debilitating Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is an autoimmune disorder which can cause paralysis, and they treated him on the front lawn of his home. Martin, what are your thoughts about this little incident down in Bridgewater?
Well, obviously, this is an improper use of the taser. Whether the taser's a good thing or not, this is an improper use of it. I think we are going to come to this later, but much more concerning for me is the decision not to prosecute in the case of Ian Tomlinson at the G20 protests. I mean, policing shouldn't be a party political matter. Everybody should support the police as long as they're doing their job properly, and there should be proper accountability for police officers. Now this police officer is clearly not doing his job properly, but the police officer that killed Ian Tomlinson clearly wasn't doing his job properly either, and the fact that nothing is being done about that second case is very, very worrying.
What are your thoughts about the use of these taser guns, which of course were involved at the scenes up in Northumberland with the death of Raoul Moat as well the other week, Mike?
Well, I don't like them, but the police need an arsenal of measures to suit the situation. This is rather, I mean, for them to be excusing the incident because the officer made a mistake is not right. It could have been a gun. And the guy could have been killed. I just worry about the whole the whole way in which the police deal with these sort of situations didn't seem to me to be a situation where you would want to even think about using a taser gun.
What about this whole thing of police accountability that Martin's talking about there? Because it does seem, if we look at that incident in London with the death of Ian Tomlinson and being struck just beforehand by a policeman, that really the police have got a sort of unspoken promise from their betters that, well, you know, we will look after you whatever you do and whatever happens. Because that's not accountability, is it?
No. Well, who else do we look to when we're in trouble? It's the police. So let's just celebrate the fact we've got people out there in uniform as policemen doing that job. Not a very easy job at all.
But what about this incident at the G20? Just moving on to that story. It's obviously a different case. But what are your thoughts about what messages that sends out for the Director of Public Prosecutions?
Well, it doesn't send a very nice message out at all, does it? But you've got a situation there which is very confused for both sides, really. Shouldn't have happened, but you know, we're dealing with human beings in stressful situations.
Right. Okay. And also, we have a freedom of information request was put in a little while ago into Avon and Somerset Police, who were the force down in Bridgewater that tasered this guy in the groin. How many taser guns, the question asks, does your force possess? And I would like them broken down by type. And the answer came back: I can confirm that the information you have requested is held by Avon and Somerset Constabulary, but having considered your request for information, I am not obliged to supply the information you have requested. So we don't know how many tasers that Avon and Somerset Police actually have, which is a great pity. I think it would be useful to know that. The whole business, also the Director of Public Prosecutions this week, we've been told, is going to bring in, and along with Kenneth Clark, it's been announced that there's going to be changes to the arrest warrants as well. This is arrest warrants for war criminals, or at least alleged war criminals, coming into Britain. This was just announced by Kenneth Clark yesterday. So we're talking about individuals like Zippy Livni, the Foreign Minister of Israel, and Henry Kissinger. Actually, what's happened is lawyers and individual members of the public in Britain have been applying for arrest warrants under international law, believing that these people are war criminals. And actually, it's meant that this Israeli minister, Zippy Livni, and possibly Henry Kissinger too, have had to cancel trips to Britain as a result. Again, this is the judicial process changing. And what are your thoughts about the International Criminal Court and these sorts of issues?
Well, it was a Labour government, it was David Miliband, who was attempting to stop these kind of prosecutions from proceeding. I think it's entirely wrong. We're trying to build up a corpus of international law which everybody will abide by, and that means we don't make excuses for people, and also that the whole decision to prosecute is independent of political control. And therefore, if Israeli ministers are wanted on arrest warrants, so for example, for the assassination in Dubai, the Dubai police have issued an arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu and his Mossad chief, and they basically have admitted that they did order that killing. Well, that makes you an international criminal. I'm sorry. You didn't have to do that. You chose to do it.
Well, he may not be able to travel to Dubai.
If the Israelis choose to be outside the law, then outside the law they must be. And it's not for the British government to try and second-guess the legal process. I think it's rather dangerous that Kenneth Clark has agreed to this kind of derogation, as it were, from our international responsibilities. But I can't really say that Labour were any better, because they were also pushing for the Israelis to get an easy ride. And I think that's the problem, is that when we're talking about lots of things, the law is not impartially enforced. Powerful people are above it.
No, I think there's a strong correlation between a full-blown system of international law applied everywhere and peace going forward. You should not be able to escape what you've done wrong when you're in a position to make big decisions just because of an international boundary.
Yes, and I also have to say, well, I don't have to say anything, but I will say that Kenneth Clark is a close personal friend of Henry Kissinger's. So it does start to look like corruption right at the very top.
Well, as you know, Tony, the US is not signed up to the International Criminal Court, which was brought in during the time Robin Cook was Foreign Secretary. And the reason is obvious, is because they know that their people are out there doing all those things that would bring them in front of that court, and they don't want to face the music.
Well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Mike Popham, Liberal Democrat councillor for Clifton East. After the news, we devote a full hour to 5 explosive ideas, which the mainstream media don't seem to want to touch with a barge pole. And the Lib Dem coalition have so far ignored, even though it affects the homes and jobs of every single one of us. Join us after the news.
Radio station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.